This show originally aired 2 years ago in December of 2019.
Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and my guest this week is Carla Stair, a retired NOAA, that's National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, scientist, and a fabric artist. We'll be talking about the nexus between art and science and how together they inspire creativity. But first, let's hear this week's mystery sound. Well, that was a fun sound. For any listeners who are fans of the Lord of the Rings trilogy by Peter Jackson, that mystery sound could remind you of the drums of the deep scene in the Fellowship of the Ring, when the band of companions identify the eerie battle screech of the approaching scrawny cave-dwelling Moria orcs. Let me assure you that the mystery sound is not the battle cry of Moria orcs, but rather the perfectly normal sounds of animals found in the Pacific Northwest. We'll identify the mystery sound at the end of this program. Well, this past Saturday, I was really fortunate to be able to be a volunteer host for the Thanksgiving wildlife cruise around Protection Island, which was offered by the Port Townsend Marine Science Center and the folks at Puget Sound Express. The day was sunny and clear with hardly any wind, a wonderful day to be out on the water. We saw lots of waterfowl, alcids, grebes, ducks, loons, eagles, shorebirds, and we spotted a single juvenile elephant seal hauled out on the shore. Plus, we expected, of course, a number of harbor seals, California sea lions, and stellar sea lions. But for me, the highlight was toward the end of the cruise when we checked out the old wooden Navy pier in Port Townsend Bay. It's sort of near Rat Island and the northeastern tip of Indian Island. Cormorants are often seen on that abandoned tower, but what made Saturday so very special was the bright, low-angle sunlight illuminating the scene. We saw all three of the different local cormorant species, and I will admit I have some difficulties telling the species apart. I keep trying to learn. I do know that if in flight, when you see them, the pelagic cormorant flies with its neck straight out, whereas the double-crested and the brants have small kinks in their necks when they fly. But for me, these black, almost primordial birds are hard to tell apart in the field. Saturday was different. The light allowed us to see distinctions. Referencing the Cornell University Ornithology Lab website, for the double-crested cormorant, adults have a small patch of yellow-orange skin on their face and throat. And although it's sometimes hard to observe during breeding seasons, adults develop a small double crest of stringy feathers. They also have, and we could see this on Saturday, striking aquamarine eyes. They sort of sparkle like jewels. For the pelagic cormorant, it's smaller than most of the others. Their necks are thin and kind of long. They have dark bills, and they're surrounded by a small patch of red skin. And the body of breeding adults, on top of that blackish color, is a green or purple, beautiful glossy sheen. And then for Brant's cormorants, which are only found on the marine waters along the Pacific coast, it's a large bird, oval body, slender neck, and they have, the adults, have a blue skin patch under the bill, and their heads have a purple sheen. So watching those cormorants and being able to see the different colors and sheen was a truly beautiful and awesome experience. And I guess that provides the segue into my conversation with Carla Stair. Carla Stair, a retired fisheries biologist for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, that's NOAA, is also a talented and exhibited fiber artist. Carla uses stitching and surface design techniques to create fiber art based on amazing and often tiny patterns seen in nature. Carla is the featured speaker at the Port Townsend Marine Science Center's Future of the Oceans lecture this coming Sunday on December the 8th. We'll talk more about that in a bit. But first, welcome, Carla. I'm so glad you could join us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So let's start just first with a little bit about your career as a scientist and the work you did for NOAA. What were you studying?
I started working for NOAA way back in 1975 in a newly formed electron microscopy laboratory that was developed because that was just the beginning of the time when we were recognizing the effects of oil spills on fish and other marine life.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of the work I did, especially initially, was using those tools to look at fish and marine life at the level of the cell to see what kinds of effects, like oil spills.
There might be some people in our listening audience who don't really know what an electron microscope is. Can you give me the, you know, one or two sentence description of how that works?
Electron microscopes are kind of like light microscopes to a certain extent, except they use electrons, so they can magnify thousands of times higher than light microscopes can.
Which then allows you to see into cells and on the surfaces of small light microscopic things, right?
Correct. And you can actually see surfaces and into cells to some extent with light microscopes. But when you need to look even closer, like at individual organelles inside the cells or much finer, like fish skin, you can see a lot more detail with fish skin with the electron microscopes, mm-hmm. because you could magnify so much higher.
So you were basically looking initially at impacts of oil spills on marine creatures?
Yes. Over the years, I've actually done a large number of different kinds of studies, basically giving me an opportunity to see a wide range of marine organisms, so that the work that I do with the fiber art, especially I like to show the really beautiful images, and so they're a collection from a number of different studies. Some of them come from the original, like what is the normal development of fish like before we needed to know that, before we can see what kind of effects contaminants mm-hmm. might have on development of fish. So a lot of the work I do, I like to show the positive and the, uh-huh. and the really beautiful parts, because it's those gorgeous structures that I think that gets people interested in learning more about the environment and also realizing that they're a lot more complex than we might realize.
Boy, isn't that
because
the
we
truth.
Can't see it.
Yeah,
with
complex and beautiful at the same time.
Yes, both.
When you made the transition outward from science to the artistic world, tell me a bit about how you did that and why.
Well, looking back, I actually think I'm not sure when there was a straight transition. Well, a recognition that it was all those beautiful structures that I was seeing. It was like the beauty of the animals is what got me interested in science in the first place. And that's why I started asking more questions. Why is this animal like this, you know? Why is this fish egg look different from a different kind of fish egg? Mm-hmm. Those are the questions that got me into science. And then the more I went into science, the more beautiful things I saw. They influenced each other, basically. And so it wasn't until many years later when I realized the photography I was doing with the, say, the scanning electron microscope was, in a sense, I was looking for unique angles to also emphasize how beautiful it was mm-hmm. and to record a moment in time, basically, what these organisms that most other people don't get to see, keeping in mind the scientific information that it was also presenting. And it wasn't until years later, I think, and meanwhile I was dabbling, I was starting to do scientific illustration and taking art classes in the evenings because I was so enthralled with the kinds of things I was seeing. And I had kept them thinking that they were kind of separate for a long time. And then we began using some of the images that we had taken with the electron microscope as educational materials to get people more interested. They would see an image of a diatom and they would go, wow, what is that? And we would say, oh, that's a diatom, and ask if they knew what diatoms mm-hmm. were. And a lot of people don't even know what diatoms are or how important they are.
We have talked about diatoms on this program before, of course, but give us a quick sort of description of what a diatom is for folks who haven't heard those programs.
So diatoms are single-celled plants. They have a cell wall made of silica, and they have stunning patterns on the outside of the cells. And they come in a huge number of shapes and sizes relatively in the diatom world because they're all microscopic. You can't really see them without a microscope.
They are gorgeous.
They're absolutely gorgeous. They're absolutely
and the variety amongst them is amazing.
Yes.
All the different shapes and surfaces.
Yes. Each species, each different type of diatom has a totally different pattern on the surface.
So I now have a visual image of the work you were doing with the electron microscopy. Can you describe your artistic creations?
Well, I use fabric and oftentimes batting or felt. So another way to describe it is like an art quilt. After trying a variety of different kinds, like drawing and painting, I kind of stumbled onto fabric. I made a quilt for a newborn niece and discovered that I really liked the organic quality of the fabric. So that method of making the quilt, which is like stitching three layers together, basically. So usually it's a layer of fabric on the back and then maybe batting or something in the middle and then another layer on top stitched together. So it's put together the same way a quilt is put together. I like to use maybe multiple layers of fabric or sheer fabrics. I like to put them together in a way that suggests what I think is really cool about a particular organism. I don't know if how well that's describing what they look like. I oftentimes add paint on the surface. I've had a lot of people look at that and go, wow, that's fabric? So it's like a collage, I guess you could say, a collage with fabric, with color and stitching added.
Oh, interesting. So a side question first. For your lecture on Sunday, are you going to bring any samples so people can see?
Yes, I will bring several of my fiber art pieces. Some of them are based on the photographs that I took with the electron microscope because the patterns that I saw, I think, are just so beautiful. I'll bring one anemone.
Okay.
because I love anemones, you
yes.
know, and the thing about, and also one nudibranch, and the thing about those is the anemones have transparent tentacles,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted to see, as a scientist, part of the reason I like the art is because I have to experiment, and I have to problem solve and figure out how am I going to do that? How can I use, you know, the fabric to create something about that organism that, to me, is really special, you know?
You know, that's a really interesting comment that you'd use experimentation and problem solving in the art, much like a scientist does.
Yes.
In our culture, it's rather common to think that science and art are sort of two distinctly different pursuits. They use different parts of the brain. You know, some folks even consider them basically incompatible. I'll bet you don't agree with that. But
I do not.
Tell me how you address that, the question of science inspiring art and art inspiring science, and the process that you, as both a scientist and an artist, how it's similar.
The similarities between science and art, I think, are that you, in both cases, you ask questions. How can I do this? And then you have to think of, well, I think outside the box, you use creativity. Like, what can I do in science? What can I do to answer the question? How do I set up an experiment? In art, it's like, what can I do to create what it is that I want to show with this? They both require problem solving. They both require experimentation. I think science is just as creative as art is. I know when I was growing up, I believed that art and science were two separate things. And that art wasn't a serious subject in school either, you know, and you couldn't make a living doing art. So they were kept very separate. Mm-hmm. And it actually took me a long time as a scientist before I started recognizing in myself, and I had kept the two parts in my mind separate. And when we started using more and more of the images that I was photographing with the scanning electron microscope as educational materials, that's when we started realizing that was the art of the photographs that were getting people interested in learning more about the organism. And so it was very effective, not only for education, but I think personally, anyone. So, and really my experience has been that they were always together. Even when I was taking biology classes in college, one of the requirements in one of the classes was we were supposed to draw our observations.
Mm-hmm.
And it was assumed that we already knew how to draw.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I was a horrible drawer.
I remember those days of having to do that in biology classes and also thinking I was a horrible artist, but thinking that as I was doing it, I learned that, well, maybe not so badly. I can draw a reasonable representation, and that the whole process of drawing really helped me remember and visualize the critter or whatever it was I was supposed to be drawing.
Exactly, yeah. And that's when I started to get more interested in drawing, because I found drawing makes you slow down and look really close at what you're looking at. So the drawing enhanced the science in that you started observing things better because you actually had to know how many hairs are there on the leg, right? You know,
yeah.
Or if you're looking at a crab or something, and you had to look really close to draw, and the closer you look, the more cool things there are. Classrooms are starting to go back towards that now and incorporating drawing in with scientific observations. At least I was asked to talk to a college group at Evergreen State College a couple years ago that was incorporating art along with the science just for that reason, because I think that they go hand in hand. Scientists in the past, that's exactly what happened. Like Leonardo da Vinci, he was an artist and a scientist.
Of course.
Or Audubon, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He had beautiful drawings of birds, but that helped him be able to study his birds more.
And I think that notion of observation and looking and, you know, even just going out tide pooling, that the more you look, the more you see.
Yes.
That holds for both science and art. It's
yes.
The same thing. Interesting. I think both creativity and appreciation and love of something is really important in our lives.
Yes. Art is really useful for communicating really complex scientific images to people that may not be scientists. I mean, sometimes a visual image can give you an idea of what's going on really easily, whereas if I try to explain in words and maybe only using scientific words because, you know, that's the vocabulary
mm-hmm.
I know from my background, you know, people wouldn't understand it. But a single image sometimes can communicate a really complex idea in a way that people can understand. So using art to get complex ideas across is becoming more and more recognized, I think, is a good way to do that process. So,
Carla, that was an amazing summary. I think our conversation has just sort of tickled the tops of that whole question of creativity in both art and science and how they inspire each other. I'm going to encourage listeners and all friends of listeners to go to the Port Townsend Marine Science Center's Future of the Ocean Lecture, where Carla is the featured speaker. It's this coming Sunday, December the 8th, 3 p.m., in the chapel at Fort Worden State Park. Her talk is entitled Art and Science of the Marine Micro World. So do check out the Marine Science Center's website, and you'll get more information there. Well, that was a wonderful conversation. Now let's look to upcoming events. Nora Petrich.
For those of you who are planners, last week's Nature Program had information about several events that are happening in the next few weeks, including the Admiralty Audubon Society's first Saturday Nature Walk, December 7th at Fort Flagler, the Kautai Work Party on Sunday, December 8th, and the Christmas Bird Count on Saturday, December 15th. You will find details about these events on the Admiralty Audubon Society webpage.
And the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society's Backyard Birding Class, Winter Care and Feeding of Birds in the Garden, on Saturday, December 7th. The Christmas Bird Count Warm-Up on Saturday, December the 8th. And the full event on Saturday, December the 16th. Plus, there's a field trip near Dungeness Landing and Three Crabs on Sunday, December 8th. Further information about all of these activities are on the Olympic Peninsula Audubon website.
As a nod to our colder, wetter, wintry weather, the Olympic Peninsula Native Plant Society is planning their December outing along the low-level elevation parts of the Olympic Discovery Trail. The walk is scheduled for Wednesday morning, December 11th. Check the Olympic Peninsula Native Plant Society webpage for further information.
Now it's time to listen to that mystery sound again and find out what it is. So, Nora, can you replay that sound?
Yeah, here we go. I know that sound was not made by orcs, as you described at the beginning of the program, but what is it?
I also know that Nora does not know what an orc is. Well, that sound was the sound of elephant seals, mothers and pups. But there's another way of answering that question. And let me do that by quoting the Lord of the Rings sound designer, David Farmer. Fortunately, very few of the orcas spoke. Remember, this is the guy who has to figure out how to add the sound. The first image I ever saw of an orc was one of the Moria orcs, and I knew in an instant that I wanted to base at least that type of orc on some type of seal. I did not want the typical sea lion vocal that everybody recognizes. I knew seals made vocalizations that would be believable as human rib cage-sized sounds. One day, my wife and I happened to be at the Marine Mammal Center in the Marin Headlands, and it was the time of year they had lots of baby elephant seals there, and a few of them were very vocal. I'd never heard the sound before and knew that it would be perfect for the Moria orcs. The Moria orcs are the smallest of the orcs, and Peter's direction for them was, quote, sort of cockroachy, close quote. We recorded ourselves scrambling around wearing cleats for the movement, but the major signature sound for them was the elephant seal pups. Who knew? So that's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you've enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. Today's sound engineer editor was Nora Petrich. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments, observations, or ideas. Email us at naturenow@kptz.org. Thanks for listening. Our closing music is the theme song from The Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Rings, directed by Peter Jackson. The music was composed, orchestrated, conducted, and produced by Howard Shore.
Dungeness River Nature Center is proud to support KPTZ programming like Nature Now. In memory of Dee and Beverly Swearingen, who taught their children and grandchildren the love and stewardship of nature. Dungeness River Nature Center, teaching generations about nature on the Olympic Peninsula at Railroad Bridge Park in Squim. More at DungenessRiverCenter.org.